Hello, and welcome to What Comes to Mind, Season 2 of The Psychonaut Show. This is John K. Burton, MD, psychiatrist, psychoanalyst, and your host on the podcast that brings ideas from the history of psychoanalysis to solve problems in everyday life. In this episode, we are going to explore the concept of the dark night of the soul. On a dark night inflamed by love longing, oh, exquisite risk, undetected I slipped away, my house at last grown still. Secure in the darkness I climbed the secret ladder in disguise, oh, exquisite risk, concealed by the darkness, my house at last grown still. That sweet night a secret, nobody saw me, I did not see a thing. No other light, no other guide than the one burning in my heart. This light led the way more clearly than the risen sun to where he was waiting for me, the one I knew so intimately, in a place where no one could find us. O night that guided me, O night sweeter than sunrise, O night that joined lover with beloved, lover transformed in beloved, upon my blossoming breast which I cultivated just for him, he drifted into sleep, and while I caressed him, a cedar breeze touched the air. Wind blew down from the tower, parting the locks of his hair. With his gentle hand, he wounded my neck, and all my senses were suspended. I lost myself, forgot myself. I lay my face against the beloved's face. Everything fell away, and I left myself behind, abandoning my cares among the lilies. Forgotten. What was that? That was a poem called Noche Oscura by John of the Cross. It's part of a series of poems that he wrote called Songs of the Soul, and that poem in particular is often known as The Dark Night of the Soul. That translation, by the way, is a new one by Mirabai Starr. And if you look it up, I highly recommend that you look up that translation. I mentioned this poem to someone who looked it up and got the translation along with John has an explanation of the poem that's quite extensive. And it almost threw this person into a major depression. The old translation is so full of old language about the devil and sin that it really comes across in a much less transcendent way than the new translation. And the new translation is not making things up. It's true to the original Spanish. And the translator, Mirabai Starr, felt that there was no good translation. She was a student of Spanish, a secular Jewish woman, but she was so moved by the poem, she felt that it was important to put it into a new translation that made it available in a larger scale that was true to the original spirit of the poem. So that's the translation that I use. And if you look it up, definitely look up the Starr translation. Now, obviously, this concept is from a spiritual tradition. It's not the history of psychoanalysis. So in this episode, our psychonautic mission will be to take us to the side of the psyche that is more towards the soul than what we usually think of as the mind. Remember, as we said in the first episode, the psyche means both. Now, I have talked about spiritual traditions throughout the podcast, Buddhism and Judaism and Christianity. But regarding Christianity, I thought I would share some of my experience investigating the spiritual side of the psyche. Someone listened to my episode, I think it was on neutrality, and wondered if I was a Christian, because I mentioned the Quakers a bit, I think. And the truth is, I'm not really sure even what that means, certainly for me personally. In my psychoanalytic training, I happened to be the lone Gentile in classes and teachers that were predominantly Jewish. I remember going to class in September, and the professor would welcome all the other students at Rosh Hashanah with Happy New Year, though she didn't say Happy New Year to me. There was another class where people were talking about the tradition of Judaism and how it related to psychoanalysis, and the tradition of not accepting the letter of what's given, but that there's a tradition of discussion and even arguing and thinking about things. And someone said, I wonder if Christianity has that element in it. And the whole class turned to look at me as if I was the representative of Christianity, which I wasn't, because although I was raised, as many Americans, sort of nominally Christian, I really didn't understand what that meant and didn't really have a particular connection to it. So this led me to investigate some things, and I would say that what I am drawn most to is what might be called esoteric Christianity. Don't really hear about that much these days, but it's about meaning and experience, not taking things literally, but looking for what's unseen and unknown. So this episode, this last of season two, may well be a love letter to my Jewish teachers. And I always felt enriched and awed by the great tradition of literature and thought in Judaism and how it informed my understanding of the mind. And this motivated me, spurred me to try and understand myself and my own legacy. But just to explain briefly what the dark night of the soul is before we go into more detail, usually, as I'm sure many of you have heard, it's sort of synonymous with something that's just a challenging time, a difficult time, and it kind of evokes that. It's also, by the way, a screenwriting term I learned recently. It is used in dramatic narrative to describe the point where the hero is in his darkest hour, where he's furthest away from what he wants, and then the rest of the movie gets us back to his goal. But the thing about the dark night of the soul, when you really go back to John's original thinking, it is a challenging time, but it is not just about being challenging or difficult or dark. It is a way of thinking about the darkness, about what it is. And what it says is that the darkness is necessary to get you where you are going. And in that way, it does have something in common with screenwriting. The dark night of the soul in creating a screenplay is necessary to take us on that journey that the hero is going on, the hero's journey. But for John in theology, it's also necessary to get to the goal that you have. It is something to walk into, not away from. So I want to tell you about a case where the dark night of the soul, that spiritual concept, was actually helpful in a kind of an ordinary way. A college student was home for the summer, and he was just walking around the city and got a call from his mother that she was at the vet. And their family dog that had not been feeling well, but wasn't old and hadn't been sick, had been diagnosed with metastatic cancer and she needed to be put down. And his mother asked him if she wanted to come. And of course, he went down to the vet and was with their dog in her last moments before she was put to sleep. He said he was sort of stunned. He didn't know what to think. And he told me, his mother said, you just need a good cry. But he said, I don't know that it's that simple. I don't know what to feel. You cry when you're sad, but it's not just that. And he said, I just want to think about something else. I need to get thinking about the fall semester coming up and everything else that I need to do. Should I be crying? Maybe it will help me get over these things. What should I do? Before we see how the dark night of the soul helped this college student figure out how to deal with his complicated feelings about losing his beloved family dog, let's look a little more deeply into the idea of the dark night of the soul. The poem that I read, The Dark Night of the Soul, is a 16th century poem about the soul seeking God. That's what John's description specifically says. And in that way, it's very religious. And typically, this would be contradictory to any psychoanalytic discussion. Freud was famously critical of organized religion, thinking of it as a childhood illusion that prevented mankind from growing up. But as I looked into this idea and similar ones from this strain of Christianity, it occurred to me that, again, the psyche is the mind and the soul, and there actually is some overlap. And I also found that I was not the only psychiatrist that thought this way. There is actually a psychiatrist named Gerard May who wrote a book called The Dark Night of the Soul, applying the dark night of the soul to psychiatric issues. One of the issues that he talks a lot about is addiction. And he talks about addiction specifically, but the idea is that there's this goal of recovery. He says that recovery itself can be seen as an idol. And I think in general that applies to getting over anything. And what he says, you know, speaking to the idea of AA and the first step of the higher power, which some people have issues with and gets in the way of making use of resources that can be helpful with addiction, he says the problem with some of the ways of looking at the 12 step is that God is seen as an agent, or the higher power is the agent. And what he says the Dark Night of the Soul tells us is it's not God as the agent, it's out there, but that the love of God, in the case of religion, the love, the striving, the seeking is what is the higher power. It's the process. And it reminded me of another situation where someone was telling me that they were having some problems with alcohol and visited an AA meeting and had a sponsor. And the person was talking to the sponsor about their doubts about the higher power and whether that would be useful to them. And the sponsor said, "Come with me," and took them out to the edge of Long Island to look at the sunrise. And when the sun came up, of course, it was beautiful and transcendent. And the sponsor said, "Did you have anything to do with that? That's the higher power." But that's really not the right message. That's sort of shaming and belittling. And what is the higher power is that feeling that you have looking at that sunrise, the longing and the love. This is what allows the person to tap into something that can help them with addiction, or in the case of our college student, with the feeling like he just had to get over it. And the idea is that the longing is what is the higher power, and that love is what the Dark Night of the Soul is about, and that love is even more important than faith. Faith is so emphasized in established Christianity. It's really the doctrine. But in these other strains, it's about the searching and sometimes not knowing, the uncertainty that is more important. This spiritual tradition, it adds something to what we've talked about already in terms of non-attachment that comes from Buddhism, that allows us to think about suffering and to come up with solutions for it. And what it adds is that there is something active, similar to the testament of active curiosity. It is an active pursuit, not a passive awareness. It's an active pursuit that's motivated by love and desire. Now, non-attachment and love are not contradictory to each other. It's a balancing act. We need both. And to bring Freud back in, his idea of libido was about a life force. We always think of it as sex, but he was talking about in the Victorian era how Victorian morals were really repressing sex, but that it is the striving for the species to propagate itself out of love and life force. And so neurosis is because something has interfered with the striving of that libido, that life force. So how did all of this help this college student who was home for the summer and feeling crushed by the loss of his animal best friend? And he was desperate to get some guidance about how to mourn and, quote, move on. And he was thinking about crying and expressions of sadness in particular. And what the Dark Night of the Soul says is that crying is an expression of love insofar as it is natural. We should allow ourselves to have it, but it's not an end in itself. It's not a solution. It's not so that things will be wrapped up. It's so that we will go into the pain and the confusion, because that is the direction of the divine. It reminds me of the father's monologue at the end of the movie Call Me By Your Name that everyone talked about as being so wonderful. And one of the things he says is that
we rip out so much of ourselves to be cured of things faster that we go bankrupt by the age of 30.
And that very much is speaking to the spirit of the Dark Night of the Soul. So I want to tell you about another case that helps us see how the Dark Night of the Soul allows us to grow. This was a man who had built not one but two multi-million dollar businesses, and he had an idea of the recipe for his success, which was that he was very focused not only on building the businesses, but on how much he put into his romantic life. He would only allow relationships with women to last a certain period of time, and then they would end, and he wouldn't feel anything. He wouldn't be distracted or worried about that. He had an idea that he would get married and have children, but that that would happen at a certain period of time in his life, according to the formula that he had in mind. But when one of these women broke up with him suddenly, he felt this sense of loneliness that he never imagined that he could have. And he was building a third business and felt he was unable to pay attention to it, didn't care, and found himself going into a deep depression. He began to confront his ideas about who he was and wondered, was everything he thought he knew about himself all just fake? We talked about how the dark night of the soul is literally in the poem about the soul seeking union with God. That message is about an experience of union. And this union can be seen as a higher level of one's own growth. The divine, the connection with the divine, is really a connection with your true self, your authentic self, as we talked about in the last episode, Winnicott's idea of the true self. And remember, this is not narcissism, which is looking in a mirror and just seeing yourself back, feeling secure, feeling everything is the way that it's supposed to be. That's the well-lit house. In the dark night of the soul, the way to God is through the self with a capital S. And the Bhagavad Gita, to use another tradition, talks about this. This is transcendence. And I don't think that I'm just trying to be politically correct and edit out the God part to make this useful for modern psychology. The idea that we have to go into ourself and seek a higher sense of ourself as the way towards God goes all the way back to St. Augustine and his Confessions. There's a new translation of these, again by a woman named Sarah Rudin, and she writes that the correct translation of St. Augustine's Confessions is not confessions, but testimonies, like our psychonautic testaments. They're witnessing.
Do I have a witness?
They've just been translated as confessions because that's what previous translators of St. Augustine have used. And Augustine was the first in the history of mankind to take the self as the starting point for finding God, and as such, he went into his personal psychology to find this higher self. And so the psychoanalytic tradition can really go back all this way in terms of the seeking of the psyche for its higher self. Now, in John's poem, he makes the analogy of the lover looking for the beloved, and it's very erotic, as we saw in the poem at the beginning. He uses another analogy, which is, for us, very close to home, of a mother and baby. The psyche is the baby here. And John writes, "But as the baby grows, the mother caresses it less. She hides her tender love and sets it down on its own two feet. And this is to help the baby let go of its childish ways and experience more significant things." How did this take on the dark night of the soul help this broken-hearted man who felt his whole way of living a successful life had been lost to him because he let his guard down and let someone in? What he became aware of in his loneliness was that he was having a new emotional experience. You can't feel alone unless you are longing for a connection. This transcends narcissism. The narcissist doesn't feel lonely because they can't be aware of other experiences. And this really hit home for him when he was out with a group of friends sitting around a campfire, and they were talking about religion and atheism. And he said to the people who were arguing for the point of view of atheism that if we didn't have faith, we would still do something. We would sit around a fire like this one and tell each other ghost stories or argue about God. And he thought, maybe it is in this desire to tell each other and listen to each other stories that is God. And so through this wrestling with this new experience, this loneliness, he was able to let go of that old certain way of looking at himself and his life and accept these painful experiences as part of a newer self that allowed him to develop an expanded view of himself and make new possibilities for his life, which included finding a true beloved with an open heart. In The Dark Night of the Soul, John refers to the devil, as I mentioned, but what he says is that progress is hidden from the intellect and the devil, and in this case, he equates the devil with certainty. And in psychiatry, we often want to feel certain, of course, which is normal. This is the well-lit house that everybody wants to stay in. And for us, it is having treatments that are manualized, focusing on things that we can be certain of, rating scales of symptoms, always trying to force the positive. But The Dark Night of the Soul says when you venture out into uncertainty, when you are questioning even the most basic of your beliefs, these are the signs that you are in the dark night of the soul. And that's a sign that you are on your way to meet the divine, that higher version of yourself. So we should probably talk about who was John of the Cross, or as we should call him, Juan de la Cruz, because he was born in Spain in the early 1500s. Now, this was after a time known as the Convivencia, which was from about the 9th to the 12th centuries, so about maybe 300 or 400 years before John came along. But we can really see him as continuing this tradition where Jews and Muslims and Christians shared ideas together, and there was a harmony of thought. According to Matthew Fox, who's a modern theologian, Matthew Fox was in the Catholic Church before he was excommunicated by Pope Benedict. Apparently, Matthew Fox's ideas were as upsetting to the authorities, much like John's were. Anyway, Matthew Fox said that the Rhine River in Germany was the Ganges of Europe in the Middle Ages, meaning that like the Ganges in India, there was a wellspring of mysticism and interest in transcendent ideas. And this group of mystics that Matthew Fox is referring to is Meister Eckhart in Germany, who was a well-known Christian theologian, but also a person known simply as Mother Julian in England. And in fact, she was the first woman to write a book in English called The Showings of Divine Love. And in it, she makes the assertion that Jesus is both a mother and a father to humanity. And there's Francis of Assisi in Italy, who danced naked in the streets, trying to bring back the spirit of King David and lived with animals. And again, in Germany, Hildegard of Bingen, who's really thought of as the mother of herbalism. And she read books from Muslims who were far ahead of the Europeans in science and medicine. And she would have visions where she saw God as a greening, Viriditas, she said. And John of the Cross is also included in this group of mystics at that time and that place in history. He had a mentor who was another mystic, an important reformer, Teresa of Avila, who was really his spiritual mother. She was part of this group called the Discalced Nuns and Monks, which meant that they didn't wear shoes, and they were trying to become more humble, less attached to the material world, and therefore closer to the God. But this was apparently very threatening to the powers in the religious hierarchy of the time. She was looking for friars to help her expand her reforms to men, and she found John along with another monk, and she joked, because he was only less than 5 feet tall, that she had found 1.5 friars to help her. But in 1577, John was actually abducted by the monks that wore shoes, apparently, who, joking aside, tortured him, beat him, put him in prison, put him in solitary confinement because he refused to denounce Teresa and her reforms. He escaped after 9 months, but it was in prison where he wrote the Songs of the Soul. And again, he is one of the voices of this mystic tradition, and mysticism is about looking for a direct experiential contact with the divine. It embraces uncertainty, is not looking for doctrine and clear-cut distinctions. He drew some of his work from another book of around that time by an unknown author called The Cloud of Unknowing, which says that God is above us and we are below this cloud that's called the Cloud of Unknowing, and we're always beating against it. And again, it's this idea of the process, of the search that's important, not the final solution. And in Islam, to go drawing on the convivencia, Sufism is the mystical tradition. And Rumi has a poem writing where he talks about the fire and the river and people lining up and going into the fire and coming out again in the river. It's very poetical, but basically saying the same thing is that it's going into the things that frighten us that bring us further ahead. And in Hinduism and the Eastern traditions, there's again this idea of the process being important. The Rishi Devata Chandas in the Vedas is the idea of how the universe began. That it begins because the observer Rishi observed Devata, the observed Chandas. And it's the process of the subject seeking the object, and it's the seeking and that process out of which things come. And there are quantum physicists today who say that the Vedas knew all of what we're discovering in quantum physics today, that nothing actually exists, only the relationship. Things only come into being when there is a relationship between observed and observing, the idea of probability waves, that all things are probable until they are observed, and then they become one thing. It's all about this paradox that truth is not knowing something, but it's found through the searching for it. So I want to talk about another situation where the dark night of the soul can be very helpful as a guide. And here we're going to take the lens and pull back from the psychological, from the individual, to the social and political. But always the goal here is to help figure out things in our daily lives, help us decide how we're going to manage. And right now, in these Trump presidential years, a lot of people are feeling like this is a dark night of the soul, and in some ways, it is a dark night of the soul for everyone. The dark night of the soul helps us figure out what is the difference between pain that helps us move along our journey from things that are truly evil, things that we need to get away from. Now, John does talk about Satan, but in Hebrew, Satan just means the adversary, and in fact, if you go way back into the Old Testament, into the Torah, that's really the only purpose that Satan serves. It's only in medieval Christianity that Satan developed a personality and a realm, but really he just existed to show what gets in the way on the soul or the person's search for the divine. And John talks about this as anything that is false. Things that are falsely secure are different from the pain that's the dark night of the soul. Now, there are some forms of Christianity that blame illness, any kind of pain, on a demon, that if you're feeling uncomfortable or pain, or whether it's a mental pain or a pain in your joints, it's because of a demon. But the dark night of the soul says some pain actually brings us to God, and how do we tell the difference? And back to Trump, for liberals, Trump is Satan.
When you see the four congresswomen, oh, isn't that lovely?
Trump is the adversary. But for conservatives, for those who support Trump, Trump is the well-lit house. Trump is the place of security. But both of those points of view benefit from considering the idea of the dark night of the soul. The dark night of the soul tells us that there is an uncertainty about where we will end. We are having impeachment now. Some people feel that impeachment is going to solve the problem. Other people feel that impeachment is just taking us away from where we need to be going. We've definitely seen a country divided and a return of hate. But as Battlestar Galactica says, if I haven't said this already, Battlestar Galactica has everything that you need to know about life and the universe and everything. They would repeat, all of this has happened before and all of this will happen again. An idea that talks about how all of this has happened before and all of this has happened again comes from the theorist, the sociologist Strauss and Howe, who came up with the term millennial and generations theory. And they say that everything turns on an 80-year cycle. We repeat things around a crisis with each of four generations repeating itself. And so it's true, we are in a cycle, but how this is going to turn out, we don't know. The dark night of the soul poses the question, what does it mean for us to go into the dark night seeking the beloved? And we can apply this on a community, on a national, even global level. It says there are no guarantees. There is no clear-cut way, because that's the very point of The Dark Knight. The psychiatrist who wrote the book The Dark Knight of the Soul, applying this to psychiatric principles, Gerard May, he quotes the Dalai Lama, who said that, although attempting to bring about world peace through the internal transformation of individuals is difficult, and we also might add as an aside that it might be impossible, the Dalai Lama says, it is the only way. And that is really the mission of the Psychonaut Show, to bring about larger changes through going inward on an individual level. So what is the lesson here? Now, I usually say at this point, it's this, but I hesitate to do that because it sounds so certain and so clear-cut. And the whole point of this episode is that uncertainty is the answer. So I'll say this, The Dark Knight of the Soul is about mystery, and it's about love, and it's also about the pain that comes from these experiences, and that we need to go into that pain. The Dark Knight of the Soul says there's not an answer out there to the psyche's anxieties and problems and questions. It's a guide. It tells us what to expect, that when we feel discomfort and pain, it may be because we are actually on the way we need to go, and that we must listen, to quote the Bible, to that still small voice that's inside of us. The Dark Night of the Soul is a natural process on the way to growth. You know, sometimes we leave that well-lit house by choice, and sometimes we're forced out, flung into the darkness. But the journey to the divine, to our higher self, is inward. It's like the Wizard of Oz, and like St. Augustine, when Glinda the Good says, you have the power within you all along. But you did have to go on that treacherous journey, Dorothy, to find it.
She had to learn it for herself.
So when you feel lost and afraid and unsure, these are the signs that you are on that path that you need to be on. And the message is that we will find our inner divinity by going deeper into the darkness and not trying to run back to the familiar light out of fear. It's love, and again, even libido, is what takes us forward. It's important to remember that Christianity has a tradition of powerful mystical thought that it shares with other great world traditions, and that has been overshadowed by the loud and black and white thinking of some established forms of Christianity. But I wanted to turn a light back to that different way of thinking. Now, this is the last episode of Season 2, and we have struggled with Season 2, so it's been sort of a dark night here on the Psychonaut Show. Not sure what the schedule was going to be, it's been kind of erratic, and even whether we would get to the end. But The Dark Night of the Soul is an appropriate place to end, and I want to also thank Coach Pamela at the Reinvention Institute, who also helped me in her own way embrace this uncertainty and keep going, putting one step in front of the other. Now we may be entering another dark night between seasons, and hopefully we will explore that, whatever it brings, together, off the podcast, and somehow figure out a way to connect in Season 3. This is Dr. JKB signing off. Since we are exploring together, you make the journey all the richer by subscribing to the show on iTunes. And even better, if you also leave a rating, it helps others to find us. If you have a story about how the concept in this episode helped you figure out something in your life, send it in, please. You can also find me on Facebook and Twitter at Psychonaut Show. Show notes are on the website, thepsychonautshow.com. And if you leave me a question, it may well be an inspiration for an upcoming episode. Until our next trip, judge nothing, question everything, and remember, there's always a reason. Bye for now. All the patient stories presented on the Psychonaut Show are created by me to illustrate an idea. Any resemblance to actual people is purely coincidental. The Psychonaut Show was created and produced by yours truly, John Burton. Art and web design by Hunter Creative. Post-production and sound design by Julio Gonzalez of Zimmer Media. Zimmer Media can be found online at zimmer.co. That's X-I-M-E-R.co.